This is the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Allison Stewart. In 2010, Vijaya Thakur was working at a human rights NGO that focused on the Democratic Republic of Congo. She worked closely with lawmakers whom she'd grown up idolizing. She drafted legislation that would offer relief to Congolese citizens, but Vijaya started doubting that her work was actually doing anything.
No matter how many victories we stacked up in terms of getting laws passed, either here on the Hill or at the UN, it never seemed to reach the people who were most affected by conflict.
Meanwhile, San Diego native Dan Driscoll was living in a small village in Morocco during a stint with the Peace Corps. He made friends with some local artisans, and repeatedly he'd see them being taken advantage of by foreign art dealers.
They go around from town to town, they buy a product at whatever price they ask for, and they turn around and sell it in the States for what they call a fair price, but it can be anywhere between 200% to 1,000% markup.
While in Norfolk, Virginia, Scott Nelson was a dot-com boomer turned stay-at-home dad.
And after about, 6 months, I just went completely stir-crazy and just had a hard time just sitting still. So I just started figuring out, what could I do while my kids are sleeping.
Now all three of these people are doing a fundamental human activity, identifying problems. And they're also looking for solutions. Vijaya, fed up with how Congo relief effort was shaking down, started her own NGO called the Resolve Network.
In our first year, we worked with 50 women, helping them start their own small businesses, and through them, we were able to help over 500 people rise out of extreme global poverty.
Dan, in Morocco, helped artists there earn more money by building a website called Anu.
Anu is an online platform designed specifically for computer illiterate artists and artisans so that they are able to use the internet to sell their products abroad independently.
And Scott, the stay-at-home dad, started building a solar steam engine.
And basically what that does is it focuses sunlight onto water, turns the water into steam, and the steam compresses, turns a steam engine, that steam engine turns a generator. And
today on our program, we're asking, where do ideas come from? What's the origin of our innovations?
I would think that ideas come from when people find a problem that hasn't been solved. Not necessarily looking for a solution, but finding the right problem to fix.
When you let go of your notions of what's possible and what's not, and you just let yourself explore, I think that's where ideas come from.
I'm fairly convinced that ideas are born from other ideas. Homo erectus, they had like one tool. They had this hand axe. It was basically a sharpened rock. There was one guy that was like, hey, let's sharpen this rock. That idea lasted for 1,000,000 years.
Hang on to this image of a sharpened rock, because science writer Matt Ridley says that is the key to understanding where ideas come from. First, let's start with Matt's broader assertion, which he made at his 2010 TED Talk, that ideas come from pretty much the same place that babies do.
In other words, you need to understand how ideas have sex.
Matt Ridley, welcome to the TED Radio Hour.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Matt, you have to explain to me what you mean by ideas having sex.
Well, if sex didn't exist, you wouldn't get nearly such progress in evolution. You wouldn't get so such complexity in bodies, because what sex does is it enables you to draw upon genetic inventions anywhere in your species. You're drawing upon genetic mutations that happen anywhere. And I'm saying that exchange had the same impact on our culture that sex had on our biology. It accelerated cultural evolution the same way that sex accelerated biological evolution.
In your talk, Matt, you show a really fascinating slide of a tear egg-shaped primitive tool.
It's an Acheulean hand axe from 500,000 years ago of the kind made by Homo erectus.
And a computer mouse.
A computer mouse. They're both exactly the same size and shape to an uncanny degree. I've tried to work out which is bigger. It's almost impossible.
So, Matt, what do a hand axe and a computer mouse have to do with ideas having sex?
I'd always been fascinated by this thing called the Acheulean hand axe, which was kind of the basic human technology that we had for about 1,000,000 years when we were called Homo erectus, between about 1.5 million and 500,000 years ago. I suddenly realized that it was exactly the same shape and size as the computer mouse next to it. So if you imagine a standard wireless computer mouse, that's the size and shape of an Acheulean hand axe. The similarity is what catches your eye between the mouse and the axe. But in my talk, I kind of say it's the similarity that's not interesting.
The differences are what interest me, because the one on the left was made to a pretty unvarying design for about 1,000,000 years. There was no progress, no innovation. It's an extraordinary phenomenon, but it's true, whereas the object on the right is obsolete after 5 years. And there's another difference, too, which is the object on the left is made from one substance. The object on the right is made from a confection of different substances, from silicon and metal and plastic and so on. And more than that, it's a confection of different ideas. The idea of plastic, the idea of a laser, the idea of transistors, they've all been combined together in this technology. And it's this combination, this cumulative technology that intrigues me, because I think it's the secret to understanding what's happening in the world. What's the process that's having the same effect in cultural evolution as sex is having in biological evolution? And I think the answer is exchange. The habit of exchanging one thing for another. It's a unique human feature. No other animal does it. You can teach them in the laboratory to do a little bit of exchange, and indeed there's reciprocity in other animals, but the exchange of one object for another never happens. As Adam Smith said, no man ever saw a dog make a fair exchange of a bone with another dog. Adam takes 4 hours to make a spear and 3 hours to make an axe. Oz takes 1 hour to make a spear and 2 hours to make an axe. So Oz is better at both spears and axes than Adam. He doesn't need Adam. He can make his own spears and axes. Well, no, because if you think about it, if Oz makes 2 spears and Adam makes 2 axes, and then they trade, then they will each have saved an hour of work. And the more they do this, the more true it's going to be. Because the more they do this, the better Adam is going to get at making axes, and the better Oz is going to get at making spears, so the gains from trade are only going to grow. And this is one of the beauties of exchange, is it actually creates the momentum for more specialization, which creates the momentum for more exchange, and so on. Adam and Oz both saved an hour of time. That is prosperity, the saving of time in satisfying your needs. Ask yourself how long you would have to work to provide for yourself an hour of reading light this evening to read a book by. If you had to start from scratch, let's say you go out into the countryside, you find a sheep, you kill it, you get the fat out of it, you render it down, you make a candle, etc., etc. How long is it going to take you? Quite a long time. How long do you actually have to work to earn an hour of reading light if you're on the average wage in Britain today? And the answer is about half a second. Back in 1950, you would have had to work for 8 seconds on the average wage to acquire that much light. And that's 7.5 seconds of prosperity that you've gained since 1950, as it were, because that's 7.5 seconds in which you can do something else, acquire another good or service. Back in 1800, you'd have had to work 6 hours to earn a candle that could burn for an hour. In other words, the average person on the average wage could not afford a candle in 1800.
Can you explain why you measure prosperity in terms of time?
Yes, this was an insight that's occurred to a lot of people in the economics profession before. This is what economic prosperity, economic growth is. It's a reduction in the amount of time it takes to fulfill a need. And that's how we fit so much consumption into our lives, is by reducing the amount of time it takes to earn it. So I think in the end, the real measure of how well off you are is how long you have to work to fulfill a need, or indeed a luxury. The difference between a need and a luxury, it becomes blurred. In the case of artificial light was a luxury 200 years ago. Today, it's pretty well a necessity.
Go back to this image of the axe and the mouse and ask yourself, who made them and for who? The stone axe was made by someone for himself. It was self-sufficiency. We call that poverty these days. But the object on the right was made for me by other people. How many other people? Tens, hundreds, thousands? You know, I think it's probably millions. Because you've got to include the man who grew the coffee, which was brewed for the man who was on the oil rig, who was drilling for oil, which was going to be made into the plastic, etc. They were all working for me, to make a mouse for me. In the case of the stone axe, the man who made it knew how to make it. But who knows how to make a computer mouse? Nobody. Literally nobody. There is nobody on the planet who knows how to make a computer mouse. I mean this quite seriously. The president of the computer mouse company doesn't know. He just knows how to run a company. The person on the assembly line doesn't know because he doesn't know how to drill an oil well to get oil out to make plastic, and so on. We all know little bits, but none of us knows the whole. And what we've done in human society through exchange and specialization is we've created the ability to do things that we don't even understand. It's not the same with language. With language, we have to transfer ideas that we understand with each other. With technology, we can actually do things that are beyond our capabilities.
In describing this true exchange of ideas, you describe all the benefits that come from it. But couldn't bad ideas have sex too?
Yes, that's absolutely true. And of course, you know, you can combine two bad ideas and come up with a worse kind of bomb. But there is a sense in which the more you share ideas, the more transparent you are, the more open you are, the more the good guys can use them and the less the bad guys can. I had a nice example of this recently when I got a computer virus on my laptop. And I went on a website to find out how to solve this on someone else's computer. And there I found right up-to-date chat rooms talking about this virus and about how to solve the latest version of it that people were sharing. People were sharing how the solutions to this problem. Now, the bad guys can't share their solutions to the solutions. They can, you know, a few of them can get together and privately email each other about them, but they can't put them out there. Otherwise, it's, you know, it makes the virus useless. So there's a sense in which sunlight is a great disinfectant on the internet and in the affairs of human beings generally. I think that the openness of people to other ideas has, on the whole, allowed good ideas to spread faster than bad ideas. Because for a bad idea to spread, someone's got to benefit from it. And on the whole, the problem with a bad idea is that a lot of people are not benefiting from it. In fact, they're being harmed by it. So they're not going to spread it.
It's the interchange of ideas, the meeting and mating of ideas, that is causing technological progress incrementally, bit by bit, however bad things happen. And in the future, as we go forward, we will, of course, experience terrible things. There will be wars, there will be depressions, there will be natural disasters. Awful things will happen in this century, I'm absolutely sure. But I'm also sure that because of the connections people are mating and the ability of ideas to meet and to mate as never before, I'm also sure that technology will advance and therefore living standards will advance. Thank you.
Science writer Matt Ridley is the author of The Rational Optimist, Nature Via Nurture, as well as other books. Matt, thanks for being with us on the TED Radio Hour.
Thank you for having me on the TED Radio Hour.
Coming up next, how can we listen better to ideas from the quieter voices in the room?
When it comes to creativity and to leadership, we need introverts doing what they do best.
The power of introverts and how we undervalue their ideas, when we continue with the TED Radio Hour from NPR.